Suddenly, he saw it right before his eyes. The Nevada was swinging out, getting underway, moving down the harbor. He paddled over to meet her. Someone tossed him a line, yanked him aboard. Two other Arizona seamen were hauled up the same way, and all three were assigned to a 5-inch gun on the starboard side. The Nevada steamed on down the channel, gliding past the burning wrecks, proudly heading for the sea. It seemed utterly incredible. A battleship needed 2.5 hours to light up her boilers, 4 tugs to turn and pull her into the stream, a captain to handle the whole intricate business. Everybody knew that. Yet here was the Nevada, steam up in 45 minutes, pulling away without tugs, and no skipper at all. How could she do it? She had certain advantages. It might normally take 2.5 hours to get up steam, but 2 of her boilers were already hot. One was the boiler that normally provides power for a ship at her mooring. Ensign Taussig had lit the second during that last peacetime watch, planning to switch the steam load later. Now his efficiency paid off. Both boilers had plenty of steam, giving the Nevada some 90 minutes' jump in getting away. Hard work in the fire room made up the difference. And 4 tugs might normally be needed to ease the ship out, but in a pinch their role could be filled by a good quartermaster. The Nevada had a superb one, Chief Quartermaster Robert Sedbury. It was the same with leadership. Captain Scanlon and his executive officer might be ashore, but the spark was supplied by Lieutenant Commander Francis Thomas, the middle-aged reservist who was senior officer present. As damage control officer, Thomas was down in Central Station when he heard that the engine room was ready. He put a yeoman in charge of Central Station, vaulted up the tube to the conning tower, and took over as commanding officer. Chief Bosun Edwin Joseph Hill climbed down to the mooring key, cut loose an ammunition lighter alongside, and cast off. The Nevada began drifting away with the tide, and Hill had to swim to get back on board. But after 29 years in the Navy, he wasn't going to miss this trip. In the wheelhouse, Sedbury backed her until she nudged a dredging pipeline strung out from Ford Island. Then, ahead on the starboard engines, astern on the port, and the bow swung clear of the burning Arizona. Now ahead on both engines, with just enough right rudder to swing the stern clear too. She passed so close, Commander Thomas felt he could almost light a cigarette from the blazing wreck. So she was on her way, and the effect was electric. Photographer J.W. Burton watched from the Ford Island shore. Lieutenant Commander Henry Ray from 1010 Dock, Quartermaster William Miller from the Castor, in the sub-base. But wherever men stood, their hearts beat faster. To most, she was the finest thing they saw that day. Against the backdrop of thick black smoke, Seaman Thomas Malman caught a glimpse of the flag on her fantail. It was only for a few seconds, but long enough to give him an old-fashioned thrill. He recalled the Star-Spangled Banner was written under similar conditions, and he felt the glow of living the same experience. He understood better the words of Francis Scott Key. It was less of a pageant close up. All kinds of men compose even a great ship's crew, and they were all there on the Nevada. As the Japanese planes converged on the moving ship, Seaman K.V. Hendon spied a pot of fresh coffee near the after-battle dressing station. He paused and had a cup. A young seaman stood by one of the 5-inch casemate guns, holding a bag of powder close to his chest. He explained that if he went, it was going to be a complete job. One officer beat on the conning tower bulkhead, pleading, "Make them go away." Ensign Taussig, his left leg hopelessly shattered, lay in a stretcher near the starboard anti-aircraft director. Turning to bosun's mate, Alan Owens, he remarked, "Isn't this a hell of a thing? The man in charge lying flat on his back while everyone else is doing something." As the Nevada steamed on, all the Japanese planes at Pearl Harbor seemed to dive on her. At 1010 Dock, Ensign David King watched one flight of dive bombers head for the Helena, then swerve in mid-attack to hit the battleship instead. Another group shifted over from Dry Dock Number 1. Soon she was wreathed in smoke from her own guns, from bomb hits, from the fires that raged amidships and forward. Sometimes she disappeared from view when near misses threw huge columns of water high in the air. As Ensign Delano watched from the bridge of the West Virginia, a tremendous explosion erupted somewhere within her, blowing flames and debris far above the masts. The whole ship seemed to rise up and shake violently in the water. Another hit on the starboard side slaughtered the crew of one gun, mowed down most of the next group forward. The survivors doubled up as best they could, 3 men doing the work of 7. It was all the more difficult because Chief Gunner's Mate Robert E. Linnertz, now acting as sight-setter, pointer, and rammer man, had himself been wounded. In the plotting room far below, Ensign Merdinger got a call to send up some men to fill in for the killed and wounded. Many of the men obviously wanted to go. It looked like a safer bet than suffocating in the plotting room. Others wanted to stay. They preferred to keep a few decks between themselves and the bombs. Merdinger picked them at random, and he could see in some faces an almost pleading look to be included in the other group, whichever it happened to be. But no one murmured a word, and his orders were instantly obeyed. Now he understood more clearly the reasons for the system of discipline, the drills, the little rituals, the exacting course at Annapolis, the gold braid, all the things that made the Navy essentially autocratic, but at the same time made it work. The Nevada was well beyond Battleship Row and pretty far down 1010 dock when she encountered still another obstacle. Half the channel was blocked by a long pipeline that ran out from Ford Island to the dredged turbine, lying squarely in midstream. Somehow, Quartermaster Sedbury sneaked between the dredge and the shore. It was a fine piece of navigation and a wonderful arguing point for Captain August Person of the dredge. The Navy had always made him unhook the pipeline every time the battleships came in or out, claiming there wasn't enough room to pass. Captain Person had always claimed they could do it if they wanted. Now he had his proof. The Japanese obviously hoped to sink the Nevada in the entrance channel and bottle up the whole fleet. By the time she was opposite the floating dry dock, it began to look as though they might succeed. More signal flags fluttered on top the Naval District water tower. Stay clear of the channel. Still lying in his stretcher near the starboard director, Ensign Tausig was indignant. He was sure they could get to sea. In fact, he felt the ship was all right. She looked in bad shape only because someone down below was counter-flooding her starboard bow instead of stern. Sitting by his 5-inch casemate gun, Marine Sergeant Inks had different ideas. He had been in the Corps forever, and knew trouble when he saw it. He was gloomily muttering that the ship would never get out. In any case, orders were orders. Thomas cut his engines and nosed her into Hospital Point on the south shore. The wind and current caught her stern and swung her completely around. Chief Bosun Hill, who had cast off a long 30 minutes before, now went forward to drop anchor. Then another wave of planes dived on the Nevada in one final all-out fling. 3 bombs landed near the bow. Hill vanished in the blast. The last time Thomas saw him, he was still working on the anchor gear. It was now 9 o'clock, and the hour had come for the ships in dry dock. The flagship Pennsylvania in dry dock number 1, with the destroyers Caston and Downs lying side by side just ahead of her. The destroyer Shaw in the new floating dry dock a few 100 yards to the west. The 3 ships at the main dry dock fought under a special handicap. The water had been pumped out, dropping their decks to a point where the high sides of the dry dock blocked most of the view. This was noticed right away by George Walters, a civilian yard worker operating a traveling crane that ran on rails along the side of the dock. From his perch 50 feet up, Walters saw the first planes dive on Ford Island. Like everybody else, he thought it was a drill, and caught on only when he saw the PBYs crumble. He looked down and realized that the men lolling in the sun on the Pennsylvania, Caston, and Downs were aware of none of this. He yelled, but nobody paid attention. He threw a wrench, but that only made them angry. As the attack spread all over the harbor, they finally understood. When the Japanese turned their attention to the Pennsylvania, Walters decided to capitalize on the ship's predicament. He devised a unique defense. He ran his crane back and forth along the ship, hoping to protect it and ward off low-flying planes. A forlorn hope, perhaps, but after all, this was a crane taking on an air force. At first, Walters's contribution infuriated the Pennsylvania gunners, who felt he was only spoiling their aim. Gradually, they learned to use him. They discovered that sitting in their trough, they couldn't see the planes soon enough anyhow. The crane's movements at least gave them a lead on where a plane might next appear. Then they could set their guns and be ready when it came. Walters was just completing his transition from goat to hero when a Japanese bomb blasted the dock, putting him out of business. It, of course, made no real difference. The planes were swarming on the dry dock from every direction. On the Pennsylvania, gun captain Alvin Girth pumped out shells directly over the heads of the next gun crew forward. He had adjusted the gun to shoot a little below the safety cutout, and every time he fired, the blast would knock down the other gun captain. He, in turn, would jump up, run back, and kick Girth in the seat of his pants. This went on and on. On the Pennsylvania, too, there was a new jauntiness in the air. Electrician's mate James Power took time out for a quick glance at his hometown paper, the Odessa, Texas Times. He just had to know the score of the big Thanksgiving game between Odessa High and Midland. Then he saw that Odessa had won for the first time in 10 years, and he jumped and hollered with joy.